I bind your hands and your arms.
I used a straw doll and named it Tom Ramoni and wrapped it with white cord and went into Alfred and projected that he would do something stupid to be caught.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed. For the past two decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun dun dun.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode 74 of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast in Limerick, Pennsylvania.
Fair.
I am your host, longtime true crime producer Ed Hydock, along with a woman who maintains a steady diet of Halloween candy, not just in October, but all year round, Melissa Spivey.
I haven't even had any candy corn yet this year. Thank you very much.
I doubt that.
I haven't. They didn't have Brock's. They had some knockoff brand, and I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, and why would you lie about that?
Exactly.
All right, Melissa, week three of our contribution to spooky season. In a block we are calling Cursed by the Past. And I have to say, that Todville Murder Mansion story was completely wild, but I think what made it wild was the fact that Bill List was so over the top, like the way he acted, that monstrosity that he built. But my God, Dozier School last week, like, that is a place that I can 100% see being haunted from just all those innocent souls and everything that they endured there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if ever there was like land that was going to be haunted, the Dozier property is like where it's at. And I also feel like the fact that these boys were murdered with no justice, that can't be good for anybody trying to rest in peace.
I completely agree. Like, that story that rattled me a little bit. It was kind of just eye-opening, you know? It was very sad, but it was also like, man, the history that exists in places that seem so innocuous on the surface. Unbelievable.
I know.
Well, we are keeping the spooky train rolling today with another case that starts in what I consider to be the mecca of all things creepy, Salem, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure everybody that has ever heard that city knows that it's notorious for the Salem witch trials. And if you aren't, I encourage you to look it up, because it was basically, I guess to sum it up, it was like a series of prosecutions against people accused of witchcraft. And it was, yep. I think it took late 1600s. Believe it or not, it led to the deaths of 25 people, including 19 unjust executions. Super dark chapter in American history, but Salem embraces it. There are memorials there, there are museums dedicated to those witch trials, because it definitely defined Salem's cultural identity, so to speak. Haven't checked it out. I definitely encourage you to go. It's hard to go this time of year because it's swamped. Like, have you ever been to Salem?
Yeah, I have been. Scott and I went up one year. Actually, it was the beginning of October, and, you know, we kind of jumped into the tourist thing and did all the little Salem touristy things, but it is a very cool town. I would like to go in the off season, because I think it would be obviously less crowded and you'd be able to do more.
That's, I think, what's it. And I think they probably play that up because it's Halloween, spooky, this and that. I know everything, like the prices of hotels and Airbnb shoot way up. That happened to me when I would try to go to Lizzie Borden's place. It was like around Halloween. Of course, it's twice as much money. Well, I'm sure you can attest that, like, in October in that area, there's just something in the air. Everything's so crisp, and just the leaves are literally bursting with color. There's 10, 12 different colored leaves on the tree. And Salem kind of comes alive with this like peculiar magic that's steeped in both history and haunting.
It's a very, very cool place.
Yes. Well, before I dig in, shout out to one of our research producers, Pam Beeler, who helped put this story together. And I want to kick things off by reading you this little blurb that Pam wrote in the story, because I read it and thought it was a perfect summation of Salem in the fall. And it's also the picture that I want all of you to have in your minds as we go through this case. Like, really put yourself in this time and place. Every autumn, Salem becomes a living tableau of its own legend. Candlelit ghost tours, flickering jack-o'-lanterns on these vintage cobblestone streets, and whispers of witch trials that echo across the centuries. It's a place where superstition and tragedy intertwine, where the veil between the past and the present feels especially thin in this small seaside city whose air carries more than the smell of salt. It carries stories.
Ooh, spooky. I'm into it. Honestly, what I was smelling that whole time was like that fall smell of like burning leaves. Like I was getting into it.
I get that, man. I'm ready. I'm so ready.
Me too.
So much like the superstition and folklore that gives Salem its kind of infamy, the story of Martha Brailsford is very, very real.
I feel like most of us think, at least I think, of Salem's dark history just being so, so long ago. To me, we feel so far removed from it.
Right. And it was crazy to think about a story that took place in Salem that wasn't centuries old.
Yeah.
This is definitely one of the most chilling stories that's ever happened there. And it didn't take place in the 1600s. It took place in the summer of 91. More than three centuries after those witch trials, Salem found itself once again a setting for a tale of deceit and violence that could be ripped straight from a gothic novel. Casual day of sailing on the ocean gone completely wrong, and a web of lies and a woman who never came home. So in 1991, Salem had just over 38,000 residents, and Neil Harrington was the 48th mayor, and a sister city that same year was established with the town of Otka, Tokyo, Japan. And for those who don't know what a sister city is, it basically is like a partnership between two cities where they open their homes to residents of the other city, kind of like exchange students, but you could also be adults. Like, where do I sign up for that? Like, can I be in an exchange program with like Sweden?
Wait, is there like a correlation between that city in Japan? Or is it just, I feel like that's really weird if someone from Japan were to come to this super witchy city. Like, wouldn't that be confusing?
I don't know. That would like, be. That's a good question. I wonder
is
if
there
Salem,
witchcraft there?
I wonder if it was like its history. And notoriety that made it like this could be an unusual place for a foreigner to experience.
Could you imagine just coming from another country and going to this town that's like full of witches and stuff? You'd be like, what is happening?
Yeah,
here?
Is this America? It's like, yes,
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, it'd be kind of weird.
Also in 1991, the old Essex County Jail, which housed the infamous Salem Jail for the 1692 witch trials, it closed for good that year, mainly because it had no running water or electricity and was considered inhumane. Fun fact, that jail, the building, is now luxury apartments.
Luxury haunted apartments, I'm sure.
Oh, duh. Yeah, if they're in Salem. Are you kidding? So one of the 38,000 residents of Salem is 37-year-old Martha Laurel Connett Brailsford. And I know that's a mouthful, but we'll just call her Martha. Martha Brailsford. So Martha had a twin sister, Muriel, and they were both born in Hackensack, New Jersey, to Norma and Herbert Conant on May 8, 1954. And Martha was raised in Cleveland and Chicago and had two older siblings. There was a sister, Carrie, and a brother, David. Martha was drawn to this area, the Salem area, in 1972 because she was a descendant of Roger Conant, who was the founder of the city.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
Well, Martha actually attended two colleges in Massachusetts. There was Endicott College in Beverly, where she studied art and got an associate's degree in 1973. And then Boston University, where she would go on to earn a bachelor's degree in German in 1975.
Hmm.
So she was bilingual.
Good for her.
So it was during this time that Martha met and fell in love with her future husband, Brian Brailsford. It was 1972 and she was 17 and Brian was 21. And they were both employed at a local yacht club. So Martha was a blind date at this end of season dinner dance, and the rest, as they say, is history.
That's cute.
Yeah. They were very close, so friends had described them as grounded, affectionate, and devoted.
Aww.
So Martha actually operated her own fashion company called Uncommon Threads and had recently launched her own interior design firm after being laid off from her job as a kitchen designer.
Wow.
And the day she went missing, she'd actually been outside painting t-shirts for her clothing line. And she was right next to her was her trusty sidekick, 8-year-old mutt Rudy, just Aww. Keeping her company. He was tethered to the railing of the porch.
Aw, well, Martha sounds super cool. She's smart. She's artistic, a fashionista, and an animal lover. Like,
right?
I'm obsessed with this lady already. Love her.
What more can you ask for?
Exactly.
Well, she definitely loved animals, and she especially loved environmental causes. So she was known for rescuing strays and was a member of PETA, and another organization called Citizens to End Animal Suffering. Mm-hmm. And she was known for rescuing human strays as well. Pick up what I'm putting down. So people who were down on their luck, experiencing struggles.
I'm down for like the animal stuff, but I don't know. That's a little worrisome. The people who she was rescuing. Yeah.
Yes, but she was not this wilting flower. So when she went missing, her husband was initially afraid that she might have pissed off like the wrong person with her outspoken nature about things that she had a passion for, like the environment, animals. Like maybe she said the wrong thing to the wrong person, and that's what happened, which we'll find out in a second. So in a book written about the murders, the authors Margaret Press and Joan Noble Pinkham said, quote, "She never hesitated to point out the transgressions of polluters. The same trait that made her a protector of the environment made her a protector of the defenseless and the vulnerable as well. Martha gave generously of her time and friendship to neighbors of all ages. Stubborn, argumentative, steadfast, and loyal. She had a mouth, and she had a heart. Brian worried that one or the other might have gotten her in trouble," end quote.
Obsessed with this woman. She sounds so freaking cool.
She's got Beth Lochtefeld vibes, doesn't she?
Yes, I was just thinking that. Oh my gosh.
Well, my first thought when I heard that blurb was, my God, that woman's a way better writer than us.
Yeah, right?
But it really does describe her to a T. Like I immediately can get a picture of what this woman looks and acts like.
I love her. She sounds so cool.
So Martha and Brian, they lived in the Salem Willows area, and this was a picturesque neighborhood with ocean views, quiet streets where everybody knew each other. They had purchased the house they live in as a fixer-upper and kind of renovated it into this cozy, artistic home with unique touches. It had a garden that was literally the envy of everyone in town.
Wow.
So in 1991, Martha was just doing her thing. You remember, she was recently laid off, getting used to this like self-employed interior designer life. She was so excited about the future and described as never being happier. Which is, aww, it kind of makes this extra sad. So while she was doing this, Brian was actually working as a ferry boat captain.
Wow. I feel like you don't hear that as a job very often.
I know, right? How often does that come up? Well, and of course, in July of 1991, it was smack dab in the middle of tourist season up there. So Brian was super busy with all these ferry trips back and forth, and he wasn't getting home from work until well after dark. So both Martha and Brian were avid boaters. So when they were both still in their 20s, they had spent 6 months on a 50-foot chartered sailboat. Wow. And he was the captain and Martha was his only crew member, which I'm listening to this going, man, what a sexy movie plot. Boat captain and...
I feel like the deck wasn't the only thing being swabbed.
Oh, womp, womp. Doesn't even make sense.
I feel like that anchor wasn't the only thing being pulled.
All right. Moving on. So as is typical of many New Englanders, Brian and Martha spent their summers on the water and their winters on the slopes. So Martha loved windsurfing. She loved swimming. She was a scuba diver. And she definitely knew her way around boats. And I had read in an article that when this all happened in 1991, she had at least 10 years of boating experience. So keep that in the back of your mind, because that will come up as this story progresses.
For real, though, these two sound like they're living the damn dream. Like, they seem to be genuine couple goals.
Absolutely. But that all changed on July 12th, 1991. So that day, Martha had actually accepted an invitation from one of her acquaintances, a guy that she had met while she had this routine that she did with her dog, Rudy. It was just a walk around the house, and she had met this guy. He was a 46-year-old widower, or so he claimed, Thomas Maimone. And on the surface, Tom had seemed friendly enough. He was a fellow dog owner, liked to go on walks. He was a sailor as well. So he had a lot in common with Martha. Mm-hmm. So they struck up this friendship. So Tom owned this 28-foot sailboat called the Counterpoint. Wow. And the two set out from Salem Willows Pier. And sadly, Martha would never be seen again.
Oh, I know we're supposed to be like good humans and help one another. Like, she's helping him with his resume, whatever. But hearing these cases week after week makes me never want to speak to another human, let alone help anyone. I know that sounds terrible, but it seems like that whole no good deed goes unpunished thing is alarmingly accurate.
It's sad, isn't it? And you don't want to live that way, because it's no way to go through life. But man, it does. And it does. These stories are cruel warnings every week. And it's not just every week, because we talk about it every damn day.
I know.
Man. Well, when Brian gets home from work that evening, it was obviously well after dark, as we talked about him working late hours, but he could tell right away that something was off. Martha's things were still there, her purse, her keys, and Rudy was still tied up on the deck. And the t-shirts that she was working on outside, they hadn't been brought in, and there were no lights on, and the shades were still up, which kind of told Brian that Martha had probably been gone for quite some time. And it was obviously alarming because at the same time, it looked like she just dropped what she was doing and left.
And I know we bring this up like all the time when we have an older case, but this is before cell phones. Like he couldn't just send her a quick text and be like, hey, where are you at?
I can't imagine that fear. Like even when you're worried about something now and you text and you don't get an answer right away.
Mm-hmm.
What if you can't even contact that person at all? I mean, that's got to be terrifying.
Imagine.
Yeah. Well, when Martha didn't come home that night, Brian was obviously overcome with worry. So now we're spilling into the next day, which is July 13th. And around 1 a.m., Brian calls the police and describes his wife. She's 5'3". She's got green eyes, brown shoulder-length hair with blonde streaks in it. And the cops take this missing persons report, but I can't honestly say how much was done in those first initial hours. And mm-hmm. that was made evident by some newspaper articles I read, too, where they're like, the police response, there were some questions about it. Just to play devil's advocate, Martha was an adult who could come and go as she pleased. And secondly, this is 1991, so I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
What I do know is that by 3 o'clock in the morning, Brian was out walking Martha's regular route that she always walked around the house with his flashlight. And again, when the sun came up that morning, but that had to be the longest night of his life.
I can't imagine.
No. When he was walking around in the morning again, that's when he spoke to a caretaker, the guy who basically oversaw Winter Island, which is a small park that housed the remains of an old military base, Fort Pickering. And this caretaker tells Brian that he actually had seen Martha yesterday afternoon, and she was with a man with a small dog. And to be clear, Brian had met Tom Maimone once when he walked by Martha and Brian's house, but he couldn't remember mm-hmm. his name. So it was like he thought he could picture the guy that the caretaker was talking about, but it took a little bit to kind of jog his memory. And eventually the two figured out that it was this Tom guy that they were talking about.
Okay.
So at 8 o'clock in the morning, then almost immediately after this conversation, Brian decides to pay Tom a visit because he was the man reportedly last seen with Martha.
And I just feel like this is where things are going to go downhill.
Melissa, so suspects don't lie in the true crime world. I just wanted to tell you that. So
no, that they never do.
This will be truthful statements by Tom, undoubtedly.
I believe it.
Tom Maimone tells Brian he hasn't seen Martha. In fact, who's Martha? This Martha you speak of. I'm not sure who you mean. And Brian's like, you know, the one you walk with several times a week with your dogs.
Oh, that Martha. That one. Got it. Noted.
Yes. Do you remember? So Rob Bettnar and pretty much every detective we talk to, really, like they talk about the people who, when they're guilty, they try to distance themselves from the crime and the people involved.
Why does that happen every single time? Remember it happened like 4 cases in a row?
I think it's human nature, to be completely honest. I think it's just you think that the response would be to like separate.
Get yourself as separate. Far away. Yeah, but it just makes you sound like a lying idiot.
It does. It does. Well, Brian continues to press Tom, and I assume that the wheels in Tom's head are churning hardcore at this point because he's like, you know what? Silly me. Ugh. I remember Martha. I did see her yesterday, but it was just for a quick walk. And then she went off to meet some friends. He would never consider taking a married woman out on his boat alone. Jeez, Brian, how would that look? Right? Gets real defensive.
That's weird.
Yeah. Well, in fact, he suggests that when Martha does turn up, they should all go sailing together. Like he, Brian, and Martha, one little friend date on the ocean.
He's being weird. Like, I feel like I got caught in a lie, and now he's just making it even worse.
Well, get this. So before Brian walked away from their conversation, Tom said, in regards to Martha, quote, I'll pray for her, end quote.
Don't love that.
Yeah. So obviously, Brian thinks this story is incredibly weird, too. So he takes the information to police, who waste zero time questioning Tom Maimone. And I'm not exaggerating like I usually do when I say, when I write that in crime scripts, they waste no time getting to the... Sometimes they do when you just say that. But like the affidavit that I read on this case, it said Tom spoke with detectives, quote, later that morning. So if he talked to him at 8 a.m., that means within an hour or two of Brian speaking with Tom, investigators were on his doorstep with questions of their own.
Hmm.
So he sticks to with exactly what he told Brian. He said, I walked with Martha that day. She went off with friends. No clue where they went. And honestly, with no evidence to prove otherwise, what can police do?
I do kind of feel like it's interesting, though, that they spoke with Tom so soon. Like, I mm-hmm. wonder if he was known to them for anything.
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if he had a history. I probably should have looked that up.
Seems like they didn't really take her disappearance that seriously at first. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh shit, we gotta talk to this guy. I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't know if like maybe they did take it more seriously than the media implied. I think I was
maybe,
going off of
yeah,
strictly one person's comment that like, we don't think police necessarily, I forget the exact quote, but there was questions in the community.
Got it.
So this first interview ends and detectives leave. But 2 days later on July 15th, Tom is brought down to the station for a second interrogation because police have some new evidence that they'd like to question him about.
Hmm.
Seems they found a witness who saw Tom and Martha getting on the counterpoint together that afternoon. So Tom agrees to come in and he admits that Martha had actually been on the boat, but he insisted the plan was that both Martha and Brian were supposed to go with him. So he stuck to his story that he would never plan to take a married woman out on his boat alone. However, he did say that he had agreed to meet Martha at Willow's Pier to talk about his resume.
Like, is that a weird place to do it? I don't know. I feel like you'd do it at your house or a coffee shop.
Yeah, but I mean, I was thinking about this. It's like, is it weird? Like, how many times have you and I done something fun, but then also like planned all the next month cases while we were doing something fun? I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. Although we like to do our MU planning and then do something fun afterwards and like not talk true crime for 5 seconds.
That's true, too. That's true. I don't know. So regardless, that's what Tom said happened.
Well, we can't trust Tom.
Why? Clearly. Well, honestly, though, in the big picture, what matters more is that Tom most certainly would take women out on his boat alone and had done so quite often.
Hmm.
And I don't want to spoil this too much, but I think this is a good spot to introduce it. So in these conversations that Tom had with Brian, as well as police, he did admit that he was a widower. But in reality, a little background check revealed that he was actually on his fourth wife. Where is said wife, you ask? Well, she just so happened to be in Kansas visiting her sister while all of this was going on.
Wow. So
that's kind of an important note. And we don't have time to get into all of these details, but in the book that I mentioned earlier, there are several names and stories from women who are approached by Tom, taken out on his boat, basically hit on by him, sometimes quite aggressively, and sometimes naked. Like, this dude liked to strip naked in front of these women. Just to, I know, right? Could you imagine getting on a dude's boat and he just...
Typical Saturday night.
He would just like get undressed for no reason and just appear almost like surprise just to see if maybe they'd take the bait.
Unintended. That's so creepy.
I know, right? So he even picked up a hitchhiker that very weekend, just 2 days after Martha went missing, and invited her to sail to Florida with him. And it was a proposition that he was so creeped out by because he asked her if he could touch her, quote, in certain places. Like, imagine creeping out a hitchhiker. Isn't it the other way around? Like, usually the hitchhiker creeps out the...
Yeah, this guy is a ridiculous creep.
This pervert was legitimately wearing a sign for the
most part. Yeah, he was.
God. Well, by the way, for anyone interested, the name of the book is Counterpoint, A Murder in Massachusetts Bay, or A Scream on the Water, A True Story of Murder in Salem, because it was released under both titles, same book.
Okay.
So if you're looking for a great step-by-step account of the entire investigation, like in the days after Martha's disappearance and or this eventual trial, check it out. It's very insightful. It's just more than we can really get into in an hour.
Right.
But here's where I do want to throw in another little juicy nugget, a book by Margaret Press. Well, she was actually a Salem native. And I say this because, interestingly, Press is now a genealogist and co-founder of the DNA Doe Project.
With Colleen?
With Colleen.
My best friend?
So, isn't that a crazy tie-in? Like, what?
That's amazing. Colleen? Oh, stop. Colleen?
Doing these stories, we are seeing all of these come together in these weird ways. Like, that whole thing with the Phoenix Canal Killer and the Lunas. And like,
this is so wild.
Well, just to recap. So, the second version of Tom's story, which was told to investigators on Monday, July 15th. So, now we're 3 days after Martha's disappearance. And Tom said the plan had always been for Brian and Martha to show up. But when Martha arrived alone, Tom claims he told her it wasn't a good idea to be hanging out. And Martha convinced him that Brian knew where she was going. So Tom agreed to hang out. And Tom says they did in fact discuss his resume. And afterwards, he took her on a quick little boat ride from Willow's Pier. It was a short distance over to Winter Island where he dropped her off. And he reiterated it was a quick trip because, quote, it wasn't a good look, end quote. And I mapped Willow's Pier to Winter Island, and it couldn't be closer. It's literally, it's like a half mile by land. So maybe a mile by sea, because you have to travel up around the tip on the island and then into Juniper Cove, where the landing is.
this guy is weird. He's being really weird about the whole wouldn't be a good look thing.
Mm-hmm.
And his story keeps changing. And Brian has already made it clear that he didn't even really know Tom. So, like, why would he have been going that day? Like, that was never part of the plan.
Well, you have not seen the last iteration of this story yet. So,
oh boy.
Hang tight. So Tom claims that after Martha got off at the landing, he moored his boat for the rest of the afternoon and so he could clean it. It took him about 4 hours, but he cleaned the entire underside of it. He said he then went home, walked his dog, Sally, and spent the rest of the night home alone because his wife, Patty, was out of state.
The wife that we thought was dead?
Yes. Who's not dead. So obviously the investigators followed up immediately on Tom's story about dropping Martha off at the landing at Winter Island. And as luck would have it, there was a police lieutenant who was there that afternoon, which was a usual thing for him. He'd often spend his afternoons there. But wouldn't you know it, not a single sign of Tom or Martha that day.
Interesting.
Right. Well, he did remember being annoyed that there were boats docked there for hours, which is against the 20-minute rule for unloading. They let you. It's kind of like a loading zone in the city. So he even sighted one of them. And luck struck again because the man who was cited for overstaying his welcome with Martha's dentist.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, right?
Wow.
So he'd actually been at the landing that afternoon and said he definitely did not see Martha there or anywhere that day.
Wow.
And in case there haven't been 900 opportunities already in this story, why don't you go ahead and cue the crow? Because this is the first time we have a direct eyewitness disputing Tom's versions of the events. Because remember, every time they had a witness, he had an excuse for it. But now it's like, now what do you say?
He is a shady-ass SOB.
Yes, he is. Well, now we have a mystery on our hands. And of course, investigators are fairly certain at this point that Martha's dead. It just the way things are lining up and just the way Tom's talking and his shady actions and stories. So they immediately ramp up efforts to find her body. Police boats were in the water all around these various islands. Based on also based on these eyewitness accounts and Tom's stories, that's kind of the areas they focused on. But nothing was turning up. And the harbor master and the Coast Guard spent about 5 hours searching the water near all these places, but there was no trace of her.
Wow.
Here, I assume, is where our loyal and observant listeners will start to wonder, hey, Ed, what's all this got to do with the paranormal? Well, I'm glad you asked.
Oh, I can't wait.
You're going to love or hate this. I'm not sure.
Oh, boy.
So one of the investigators, Captain Paul Murphy, decided to call a friend of his named Laurie Cabot. And I'm so happy this woman came up because digging into her was a trip.
Really?
Laurie is a witch. Okay. And not surprisingly, Laurie had experienced her fair share of harassment from the religious people in the area. They were obviously opposed to her craft, which she practiced out of her shop in Salem called Crow Haven Corner.
Oh, I love it.
I know, right? And there were members of law enforcement who turned a blind eye to people they considered troublemakers, like a witch. But Captain Murphy, he took this oath to protect all citizens. He had developed such a good rapport with Laurie over the years. Like, even if he was skeptical about what she was doing, he thought she was a cool person and a trustworthy person and someone he could turn to for help.
Now, that's a good cop right there.
Yes. Who non-biased.
Might not agree with everything that you do or believe, but wants to protect you anyway. That's how they
turns out you can do that. You can have opposing opinions and still be a good person. Crazy.
That is wild.
Well, let me try to paint a picture of this woman for you. So Laurie was in her late 50s. When I show you a picture of her, you're going to lose your mind because she's an old witch at this point. It's like everything you see in every storybook.
Is she still alive? Side note.
Yeah.
Could we get her on the show?
Yeah. I don't see why not.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Okay. Sorry.
She's 92 and she's on Facebook and YouTube.
Love her.
Well, at the time, in 1991, Laurie was in her late 50s and describes herself as a witch, a psychic, a medium, a teacher, and author of several books. She developed an early interest in the occult and moved to New England and settled in Salem because obviously the epicenter of the occult. And in 1971, she capitalized on the national exposure of Bewitched.
Elizabeth
Montgomery.
I loved that show.
So she opened Salem's first witch shop.
Ooh.
And you know it was bougie because there was an E on the end.
Oh, yeah.
Shoppe. Well, by the way, it was the first shop in the United States solely devoted to witchcraft.
Oh, that's so cool.
Oh, and when I said she authored books, did I mention it was six of them? Or that she was declared the official witch of Salem by Governor Michael Dukakis in the 70s? Like, this woman is a literal legend.
Love her.
Driven to defend her religion, Laurie established the Witches League for Public Awareness in 1986 to basically counter negative publicity. It was an effort to defend witches everywhere.
Okay.
She also opened later shops, including The Cat, The Crow, and The Crown, as well as Crowhaven Corner, which is where the detective found her, the one I mentioned
wow.
earlier.
Wow.
And Laurie had always identified herself as a witch and raised her daughters in the same faith. And she continues her work through an online business. She even founded, get this, she even founded her own tradition of witchcraft, which, you know, I had to look up for more information.
Yeah.
On. So according to an article in Pathos.com, Laurie's witchcraft stems from the traditional witchcraft of the witches of Kent, which has expanded upon her own research into science, metaphysics, and witchcraft.
That's so cool. You go, girl.
Right? So Laurie claims to have been contacted numerous times by police departments all over the U.S. for help, but never by her local PD until now. Hmm. So I think she's kind of honored.
That's great. Good for her.
Yeah. So around 9:40 a.m. on Thursday, July 18th, 1991, Captain Murphy tells Laurie about Martha being missing and explained they were about to conduct another air search over Gloucester Harbor and asked if she could help. And Laurie was like, I'll give it a try. So her psychic process involves getting into what she calls a, quote, alpha state, which mm-hmm. is basically like a meditative trance or a hypnotized spell. She claims to be able to see like past events very clearly when she's in this state, which is wow. wild to me.
Yeah.
So she tells the captain that Martha's body would not be found near Gloucester, but near a small island off Marblehead, some 20 miles southwest of Gloucester. This is by land. Mm-hmm. And Laurie further relays that Martha was on the bottom of the ocean, weighed down by something heavy around her waist.
Oh.
And this may not, this seems like just crazy witch talk at this point, but it's going to all, you're going to go, oh my God. So Laurie claims to have seen the entire horrifying murder of Martha Brailsford. She shares with the investigator that the killer was a good navigator who knows the area well. She said that whoever did this came on to Martha and an argument ensued. And according to Laurie, Martha threatened to expose something she knew about her attacker, at which point he hit her on the head with something like a wrench, she was guessing, sexually assaulted her, and tied something heavy around her waist.
Ooh.
And she was screaming for help, according to Laurie. And side note, interestingly, part of this investigation, officers did get a tip from someone who allegedly heard arguing and screaming around 8 p.m. that fateful Friday night, right around the same area where Laurie said Martha's body would be resting at the bottom of the ocean. Laurie also mentioned that Martha suffered a non-fatal head injury to the right rear of her head behind her ear and that she was either strangled or left to drown. Crazy talk, right?
Wow, that's scary. And normally I don't condone psychics getting involved with like police investigations, but this seems, I mean, it seems legit.
I mean, it seems legit because I think you know the end of the story. But if you're like, picture being this captain going to her and she's telling you all of these crazy details, you got to be like, I'm sorry, what? Like, it's very specific.
And my brain would go to, are you part of this? Like, I would be like pointing exactly. the finger at her for knowing
this. I have thought that about certain psychics involved in these cases.
Yeah.
They know too much. And I suspect that they will watch a crime scene from afar. To get details.
Interesting.
That's my theory, but we can talk more about that in another block.
Yes.
Well, this may not be so crazy after all, because later that same day, July 18th, and some people say it was within an hour or two of talking to the captain, a lobster fisherman named Hooper Goodwin III, or Hoop, as he was known, he was picking up his traps near Marblehead, and six traps to be specific, and the first five came up super easy, but then there was that sixth trap. And it was heavier, it was harder to get up, and as he's pulling up the rope, he sees something horrifying tangled in the ropes.
Oh, was it Martha?
It was sort of Martha. So, and this is right where Laurie Cabin said she would be, right near this small island named Cat Island off Marblehead.
That's wild.
Right, and Hoop first spotted her foot, and then this brown hair, and then her head, and she was naked, but ravaged so badly by marine animals that she was almost skeletonized. And there was a 12-foot rope attached to her ankle, and the other end of that rope was attached to a small anchor, and she was weighted down by a diver's belt buckled around her waist.
What's a diver's belt?
I actually didn't know that either. I could guess what it is because I've been scuba diving before. Like, you basically put on weight to make you perfectly buoyant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But Google, so I did look it up for people who don't even know what that is referring to. And Google says a diver's belt is a weighting system, usually a belt worn around the waist, used by scuba divers to counteract the natural buoyancy of their diving suit and equipment, helping them to descend and achieve neutral buoyancy underwater. These belts hold heavy lead weights and are fundamental and are a fundamental tool for buoyancy, control, and stability while diving.
Well, that sounds like something heavy, like Lori said.
But isn't that insane? Like, if she literally had no knowledge of this case. Here's the part that's really disturbing, though. This actually matched a missing diver's belt from Patty, Tom's wife, her diving gear.
Oh, shit.
So, although the official cause of death was drowning, she hadn't drowned accidentally. Medical examiner found 5 separate blows to her head and face. And the dentist, the one who received the citation for being docked at the landing too long, was the one to identify her through dental records. Crazy.
I feel like they should have dismissed his citation for helping out.
The least they could do.
Yeah.
So police obviously at this point want to go arrest Tom Maimone. But he was nowhere to be found. Apparently, he'd heard about the discovery of the body on the news and hightailed it out of town. So Tom was gone. So Tom had actually told his wife that he was going to see his lawyer to get help. And Addie actually believed him. And I think a lot of this stems from the fact that he might have told her, like, I was with Martha that day. Mm-hmm. She's been found. They're going to suspect I did it. So I'm going to get help from my lawyer. But the interesting thing was it wasn't made clear on the news that she was found with a diver's belt and an anchor. So Patty was believing her husband had nothing to do with this, but I don't think she got the full picture. And if she was getting it from Tom, we all know he's a shyster.
Yeah, he's a liar. Well, I feel like the police should just ask Laurie Cabot where Tom is.
They did. So they actually did. So they called her and they asked if they have any idea. They call her and say, do you have any idea where Tom might be? And she shared that she believed he was going to Canada and had shaved his mustache. Again, where are you pulling this from? So she says, quote, he feels like he can con anyone and had an ego too big for suicide, end quote. Mm. And she offered to put what's called a binding on him to like encourage him to either turn himself in or screw up somewhere so that he could be captured, like a witch spell.
He's frantic. He doesn't know where to go. He's thinking south, west, and now he's thinking north. He's decided to go north to Canada.
Lori offered to conjure up a spell to derail Maimone's plans.
Tom Maimone, I bind you. I bind your hands and your arms. I used a straw doll and named it Tom Maimone and wrapped it with white cord and went into Alpha and projected that he would do something stupid to be caught.
Interesting. And before you said that, though, I feel like the part about like how he can con anyone and an ego too big for suicide, like she should work for like the behavioral analysis unit.
We need to get this lady on the show because she is so interesting to me.
That's like, so cool.
Fascinated. Lori actually goes on to share even more information that she like what she was seeing in her mind about the murder. She saw Martha on a boat's deck with some papers on a night. Could be resume paper. Like,
Crazy, right?
On a nice day, and that Martha had a clear boundary of friendship with this guy. She said Tom was surprised at how strong Martha was and reiterated that she wasn't dead when she went into the water.
Oh, poor Martha.
I know. Well, it didn't take long for Tom to get caught. He was actually captured after breaking into a cabin in northern Maine on his way to Canada.
Damn, she's good.
Like, what?
Wow.
So he'd actually told officers in Maine who apprehended him that he was looking for a Catholic church before he was going to go turn himself in. And whether that's true or not, we'll never know because Tom was a prolific liar. Police eventually learned that he lied to his employers about his educational credentials and his work history. Obviously, he lied to women about being a widower. He lied to Brian. Mm-hmm. He also lied to the cops. And he even greatly embellished his military service.
Wow. So
he was a piece of work.
Yeah.
Tom is now in custody and he's again interviewed by police. And Melissa, I hope you're sitting down because Tom is about to tell a third version of what happened that day.
I feel like we're past third. I feel like we're on like his 57th version of what happened.
It's only the third. So according to Tom, you see, this was all one big tragic accident. He says that he and Martha had in fact gone sailing near Marblehead and quote, a rogue wave hit the boat. She fell, hit her head, went overboard, I froze, end quote. And I'm going to refer now to the affidavit that I was using for some of these things because it does give some more details on, and I think it's right here. Okay. He said that he had sailed with Mrs. Brailsford as far out as Gloucester when a rogue wave or two struck the boat and Mrs. Brailsford's face hit the mast. Mr. Raimondi told police that Ms. Brailsford fell overboard and drowned before he could spot her. He said he froze and did not call the Coast Guard.
Yeah, why didn't he just tell them that in the first place if that's what really happened?
Excellent question. But the bigger question to me is, like, why didn't he immediately radio police after he returned to, like, the shore?
Like, he's a liar.
Yeah, it's so many opportunities. Like, it's horseshit is what it is.
This is reminding me of David Reed's case where, like, why didn't you just tell what happened? Like, he could have been saved. And
Well,
because I know.
This didn't happen. Yes.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, this was no accident.
Right.
So the trial of Tom Maimone begins in 1993, and obviously the evidence against him is fairly overwhelming. But in our absolute favorite courtroom moment, Maimone takes the stand and tells yet another version of what happens on the counterpoint that fateful day. And for those scoring at home, that's number four. Story number four.
Wow.
And this time he said he blamed the same rogue wave, knocked Martha overboard, but that he tried to save her, that she died in his arms, and he panicked. And I'm going to again reference and just read kind of directly from the affidavit because it pretty much lays it out. In this version, Mr. Maimone saw Ms. Brailsford swimming toward the boat after she fell overboard. He could not make eye contact with her, so he did not throw her a flotation device. Instead, he tried to maneuver the boat with its swim ladder toward her, but she did not seize it. He said he pulled Miss Brailsford out of the water and tried to revive her with CPR and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. He testified that he panicked after she died, and because he could not bear to have the body on the boat, he attached a weight belt and anchor and threw Miss Brailsford into the water.
What?
Well, on the stand, he also admits to lying about pretty much everything in his life.
Yeah.
Even his own defense claimed that he suffered from multiple personality disorders, and that's what made him compulsively dishonest. So then the jury hears from two other women who Tom had lured on his boat in the days before Martha's murder. Remember, I'd mentioned there were some stories that we didn't really get into, but he had told both of these women about his wife dying of cancer, which was a lie, of course, before becoming sexually aggressive. And these women both survived, as well as the third woman, the hitchhiker, who we picked up 2 days later.
So I feel like what Laurie said was true. Like, he came on to Martha and then she told him to stop or whatever. And remember, Laurie said something about Martha knowing something.
Yes.
And she was going to tell everyone. Like, I was about to say, I wonder why Martha, like, those people lived and Martha didn't.
I don't know.
If Martha really did have dirt on him, I don't know.
I wonder if things just got so out of hand with Martha that he felt like he crossed a line that he couldn't come back from. I don't know. Well, whatever the case, the jury saw through these lies. And in February of 1993, Thomas Maimone was convicted, not of first degree murder, but of second degree, and sentenced to life with the possibility of parole, which he did go to the parole board several times over the years. He still the whole time claimed this was an accident, still insisted that this rogue wave took Martha's life.
Yeah, and the parole boards usually aren't down with inmates who won't, like, admit that they were wrong, that they did something wrong.
No, they look for, like, I don't know, genuine remorse.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and again, I'd like to read directly from this affidavit because it does offer some additional details that'll either make you feel bad for this guy or hate him even more. So, yeah, you decide. And this comes from his hearing on October 4th, 2016. So at the time, he was 71 years old, just to give you some frame of reference here.
Wow.
So at this hearing, Mr. Maimone was asked to discuss the events that transpired on the day of Miss Brailsford's murder. He said that he was married to his fourth wife at the time and that she had gone to visit her sister out of state. Mr. Maimone stated that he and Miss Brailsford were not engaged in any sort of quote-unquote tryst, nor did he have any romantic intentions. When asked if he had previously taken women out on his boat and made advances toward them, Mr. Maimone replied, quote, I had an unselfish concern for a lot of people, and a lot of people came into my life, women and men, and I engaged in relationships with them. Not sexual, not romantic.
What?
So there's that. And then he again stressed that he thought Mr. Brailsford, Brian, was going to be on this trip with them that day, and he had second thoughts about even taking Martha out on this boat, but she convinced him that he knew about it, everything was fine. So he says that he and Martha sailed the local waters and had plans to meet some of his friends who would be on another boat that day. And here's from the affidavit. Mr. Maimone said that his friends had been late showing up, and at 8:30 p.m., Mr. Maimone and Miss Brailsford decided to sail home. At that time, they were in Gloucester, and Mr. Maimone made the decision to transition from sail power to auxiliary diesel power. According to Mr. Maimone, Martha went up on the deck to retrieve the main sail, and a wave hit the boat, sending her airborne. Mr. Maimone had said Miss Brailsford landed on all fours on the deck. He claimed that he did not attack Miss Brailsford and that she was not injured while on the boat. He said that Miss Brailsford was subsequently ejected from the boat when the second wave hit. He said that he then went into what he called recovery mode, which he made efforts to bring Martha back onto his boat. By his estimate, it took Mr. Maimone about 15 minutes to recover Miss Brailsford from the ocean she fell in. He said that she was unconscious and not breathing when he got her back on the boat. He attempted to perform CPR. Mr. Maimone was asked how long he was on the boat with Miss Brailsford's body between the time that she died and the point when he dropped her in the ocean. And he said 7 hours transpired.
What?
As to why he weighed Miss Brailsford's body down with an anchor and a diving belt, Mr. Maimone said he blacked out. And through treatment, okay, he's trying to figure out what his state of mind was at the time. Mr. Maimone maintains that he did not kill Miss Brailsford, but said that he takes responsibility for her death because she was on his boat. I feel like he opened up a little bit more, but he's still not. And for that reason, they said, you know what? No, you're not getting out ever.
He's a liar. He's just making up more stories. He's just had more time to think about like what the stories are going to be.
But dude, just show, you have a better chance of like sticking to one of those stories and showing remorse for it, about getting like, instead of changing it again and again and again.
Yeah. And the whole, oh, I blacked out. I'm so sick of hearing
everybody
about
blacks
that.
Out. I know. Well, the parole board did not buy a word of this garbage, and they concluded what everybody had already suspected, that Tom had already tried to make a move and Martha resisted and he killed her for it. And whether that was by beating her or throwing her overboard, like after she was unconscious, don't know. But in their final parole decision, Tom's third attempt, they said Mr. Maimone has no chance of success on parole in his current state of pathologically lying, end quote.
So he'll never, ever get out.
Well, he's dead. So.
Oh, well. No,
he actually died in prison later that year. He was 72. So,
I mean, I guess in a way that's kind of closure for Martha's family, but nothing is ever going to bring her back and nothing's ever going to close like such an evil and senseless murder.
Senseless is right.
Yeah,
I agree. And I didn't mention that there were some suspicions about Brian early on. Like there always is in cases like this with a missing spouse,
of course,
but
yeah.
He was cleared pretty quickly. And Brian and all of Martha's family were super active the entire time that she was missing, that first week before she was found by Hoop. And it sounded like these are the guys that weren't really thrilled with the police response. But I think that's just because they were doing more than police. Like, I don't know what police were doing behind the scenes, but I know the family was working tirelessly.
When you're in that situation as the family, I think that the officers could be doing everything in their power and you would still feel like it's not enough.
Exactly. I mean, there's no better way to put that, because your loved one in your mind is the most important thing in the world. Police try to take that into account, but you're not the only case they're working. So
right.
I feel like sometimes they have to use their judgment, and sometimes it's right and sometimes it's wrong.
Right.
Just an update on kind of where what happened after that. So after Martha's body was found, and especially after the trial, her family members, including Brian, had all kind of asked for privacy and have rarely spoken about this case. Mm-hmm. And a quick Google search revealed that Brian lives a quiet life as a marina owner now, and he's still pursuing his love of the sea. So that's good to see.
Aw, I hope he's found some sort of peace after, you know, what a horrific trauma he's been through.
Yeah.
I wonder what he thinks about Laurie Cabot.
Yeah, it's hard to say, because I mean, for him, for all of Martha's loved ones, her death isn't, it's not a ghost story. Like, it's real.
Yeah.
It's not folklore. It's not legend. It's a brutal crime that happened to a real family in a city already known for its darkness. You know,
it's wild, though, because like it happened in this town of Salem, where we expect witches and superstition and like all this scary stuff. But the scary stuff was actually a real human.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like we talked about in the beginning. It's crazy to hear a story in Salem that isn't about witches, but it
right.
is kind of.
Well,
Laurie Cabot was a witch.
Yeah, that's wild.
Oh, man. Well, I want to wrap this up by reading a poem that we came across while researching, and it was written by Hoop. The guy who found the body.
Who found her, yeah.
Yeah, and he was embraced big time by Martha's family.
That stuff like that always makes me happy.
I know, because he didn't do anything. He actually provided some level of closure by what it, obviously that yeah. I'm sure that vision is stuck in his mind too forever yeah. of what oh, he I'm saw sure. that day. So this is a poem called My Ballad to Martha.
Aww.
For whatever reason, that warm summer season, she was stolen from where she belonged, brought back from the sea by God and by me. I pray for her family and her soul.
Aw, Hoop.
Right? Well, that, my friend, is the haunting story of Martha Brailsford. A little outside the haunted crime scene box, but I mean, is it? Like, it doesn't get any spookier than Salem. So when we found a case that happened there, it was like kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it totally falls in with the haunted property thing. You know, we had, in my week, we talked about, like, a haunted neighborhood. Then last week, we talked about, like, a whole haunted compound kind of thing. And now we're just talking about the whole town.
Yeah, I mean, Salem has this reputation that ever since I was a kid, and I think people don't necessarily understand why. Like, I would think a new generation of people, if they're not up on all the history, you just hear Salem, Massachusetts, and spooky, and you just think, you know, by reputation, it's spooky. But do you know why?
I feel like most people know, because don't people still read like The Crucible and stuff in high school?
Do they really?
I think so. I know that. Really? We did in English class. Yeah. Oh. And actually, one of the schools that I'm associated with, they're doing The Crucible for their fall play.
Oh, yeah. Do you see the shirt? I didn't do a lot of reading in high school.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that was an interesting case. And next week we have Catherine. I'm so excited.
I know. We have a date for her interview, and I got to make sure it doesn't coincide with my next shoot. So that would be awful planning if it did.
Yeah, well, we'll just have to cancel your shoot because Catherine is a billion times more important than, you know, your job. We went mini golfing last year on Halloween, remember?
Oh, we did, didn't we?
Oh, and that face in the window.
Oh, my God. There's a mini golf course right by our house.
My God.
We had some libations before we left, and we decided to go mini golfing. And we got to this house. They make the whole golf course creepy. They put up like inflatables and they trick it out with Halloween decorations. But this house that is usually a farmhouse was like this spooky house. And Melissa saw this face in the window.
So ridiculous.
And jumped 10 feet in the air.
And but the worst part was that I said, oh, they should put a creepy face in one of those windows.
Yeah. And you just walk by and they're like,
shit my pants. I might have a little bit. I screamed.
That was so much fun.
Oh,
I remember some Halloweens, like, I don't know if you remember as a kid, but going trick-or-treating and it either being 1,000 degrees in your costume or like you're mm-hmm. freezing and you need a blanket in between stops.
I remember in third grade, I was a pink Power Ranger because that was the time. And my grandma made my costume and she had made my pink Power Ranger costume out of felt. Well, it just happened that year was like 80 degrees and I just remember dripping in sweat inside this felt
costume.
It's
trying to like put on long pajama pants or long sleeves right out of the shower or underwear and socks. It's just like,
But at the same time, it was always the worst when your mom made you wear a jacket. Like, Disney princesses don't wear windbreakers.
It was so stupid. She was probably standing on the curb. Like, you would walk up to the house, but she would be standing right there just to make sure you were safe. And
mm-hmm.
Was that just me?
No, that was me too. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I remember this one year. I forget how old we were, but we used to go out for mischief night the night before.
I never did that. I was good.
You did. Well, you did harmless stuff. You never did anything that caused toilet paper, a couple eggs, yada, yada. But I remember one time we were out trick or treating and we knocked on this door. Nobody answered. And we didn't used to have the universal rule where if your light's on.
Yeah.
So it was just, you just go to houses. It's like, hey, trick or treat, motherfucker.
Let me in.
So I remember vividly that nobody answered the door. We turned around and started walking back to go to the next house. And then the door opens all of a sudden. And this guy is in like a towel, right? In just a towel. And you can see like his wife in the back, like they were totally shtupping. Like, and they decided to,
my
why
God.
They, answer, I don't know if they didn't expect people or what, maybe because they didn't have their light on and we just missed the sign. But he goes into the bedroom and comes out with a change jug and just let us all take handfuls of change.
Oh my God.
$12.
I don't want your change, Mr. Nakey Towel Man.
I do. I'll take all your change. Keep it coming, mister.
No, please don't.
Oh, man, that is our show today, guys.
Well, I would love to hear what everybody's favorite Halloween costume was when they were a kid. And you know where you can tell us all this stuff, but I will remind you on our socials, Facebook, Insta, Blue Sky, TikTok at Murder Unscripted. You can hit us up on Reddit. We have a Reddit. We have a subreddit. We have a Reddit page. All of the above at Murder Unscripted. You can email us murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or you can send us a note through our website, murderunscriptedpod.com, or just type it in Google. You'll find it.
Yeah, it'll come up.
But stay tuned for next week because we have Catherine Ramsland on. I'm so excited. This is like meeting an idol for me, so I'm pumped.
I'm excited to watch you squirm.
I know. I'm getting nervous to talk about. I'm going to need my inhaler. I'm going to have, it's going to be wild. I'm going to probably start crying. So
I
there's
hope.
That.
I can't wait. You rub it in your face.
No, I'm cool. I'm cool.
Mm-hmm. We'll see.
I'm not cool. Anyway, until next week, stay safe, stay hydrated, and remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
But they do shtup their wife on mischief night and give you change from their coin jar.
I was going to say, but they do hand out change in a towel.
It was mischief night. Armed robbery is included in that. Give me your money.
Yikes. Bye.